Hi, I'm Casey.
And I'm Joe.
And this is our podcast, Four Letter Town.
A podcast about faith, creativity, and small town life.
Okay, we're back with Four Letter Town. This is Casey.
And this is Joe.
And today we have someone special. I'm going to have a conversation with Steve Hopkins. He's actually Joe's uncle.
Hi, Uncle Steve.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Casey.
Hi, thanks for joining us today. So, Steve, to start off, how about you tell the audience who you are? Any way that you've always wanted to introduce yourself. Go ahead.
All right, thanks. Well, I have to start by saying that I am the uncle of Joe, and so it's a pleasure to be on this blog. I've done a lot of things in my life. I'm participating in this blog from Des Moines, Iowa, in my home in Iowa's largest city, even though I can say that I am a former dairy farmer. And you say you wanted me to talk about how I would like to introduce myself. That's part of my past, and was a very joyous time in my life was when I was dairy farming. I'm also a husband and father of two sons, and happen to have a great career with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and Water Quality here in the state of Iowa. I'll just leave it at that as my introduction today for you.
That's awesome, because we're going to probably go into a lot of those topics throughout our conversation, because I definitely want to know more about those things. I don't know much about dairy farming or the water work that you do, nothing like that. So I'm looking forward to learning more. So tell us about how you became a dairy farmer.
I became a dairy farmer. There were a lot of steps along the way to becoming a dairy farmer, but it grew out of my work that started after college. And I went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, up in Northeast Iowa, which has been a dairy region in the state of Iowa. But after college, I worked for the Center for Rural Affairs' Small Farm Resources Project in Northeast Nebraska. And this is back in the early 80s. And through that work, our project was working with a number of small farmers in Northeast Nebraska, many of whom were dairy farmers that had small dairy farms. And so I became very acquainted with the work of their work in Northeast Nebraska, working with dairies. And in addition, I became very interested in rotational grazing practices, and that led me to visit a number of farms that were beginning to implement rotational grazing. And I should say what that is.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
back in my grandfather's day, they used to refer to what we call rotational grazing now. They used to call it cross fencing, where a pasture would be divided into four parts or maybe two parts, and they would move a herd of cows from one to the other. But rotational grazing, or what could be called intensive rotational grazing, is a much more management intensive practice, where a herd of cows, and it could be any species of grazing animal, are moved more frequently than once a month, like Grandpa used to do it. In the case of many of the farms that were implementing rotational grazing 30 years ago, when I was starting to study it, it was moving a herd of animals at least once a day, and sometimes twice a day if it's a dairy farm. Wow. And the purpose behind that is several fold. One is to enable the herd to act like a grazing animal herd, where they're moving into a fresh pasture of grass, grazing it nearly completely, and then moving on to a different pasture. And by moving out of the old pasture, that provides a rest period, which in especially drier climates is really important, because that helps the pasture regrow. And if cows are not moved to a different pasture, they're allowed to regraze growing plants, and that's overgrazing. And there's a misconception about what overgrazing is. It's not because there are too many animals in a pasture. It's because they aren't moved away often enough, or they may be returned to that pasture too soon before the roots have been able to recover in a pasture. And that type of grazing system simulates what naturally happened with herds of bison or elk that were kept bunched together by predators, because in prairie ecosystems, herding animals were bunched together by predators, and they would move to fresh grass, and then they may not have returned to those previously grazed areas for a month or 2 months or 6 months, and that allowed for a regrowth of really lush prairie grass, at least in North America. And that's really what a lot of farmers are trying to do with rotational grazing, is to simulate that herd action that was, you know, we have eliminated, because we mostly eliminated predators. So it's a way of really getting the most out of pasture work. So I was really interested in rotational grazing, and I had visited farms in Pennsylvania, including dairy farms in Pennsylvania, Ohio, various states around the Midwest, and I took a trip to New Zealand in 1990. Wow, that was 30 years ago, where most of the country's agriculture is based on some form of intensive rotational grazing. And so I was, during that 3-week trip to New Zealand, I was able to visit dairy farms, beef operations, sheep farms, goat farms, the whole gamut of grazing operations in that country on flat ground, mountainous ground. It was truly an amazing trip. So I was interested in bringing some of those ideas back to Iowa, where I was living at the time. But I had also worked on a dairy farm in Wisconsin for a period of time, and realized that I really loved dairy cows and loved working with them. So that led to my interest, and Sarah's and my interest, in getting into dairy farming in some way. And because it's expensive to get into farming, and we didn't have money, nor did we didn't inherit land or any labor or capital, we started out looking for farms to rent. And so we started dairy farming by renting a very small hilly farm up in northeast Iowa near Decorah. And we rented the farm, and we rented a herd of dairy cows, which is something that not very many people do. And it was a way for us to get started without having to buy a lot of, you know, buy the animals up front. And we rented a tractor. So we had rented land, rented cows, and rented a tractor, and got started farming. And most of what we were doing was not only milking this herd of cows, but I was also building portable fencing to implement a rotational grazing system on that farm. So this was back in 1992. It was probably one of the first dairy farms in Iowa using intensive rotational grazing methods, even though it was a small herd. And so we farmed in northeast Iowa, and then we're really interested in getting our own place. And we ended up buying a really rundown farm in central Iowa near Newton, and moved our dairy herd there, and then lived there for about 20 years on that farm. We didn't milk the entire time, but we did live on that farm for 20 years. So anyway, that was our journey, Sarah's and my journey, to begin dairy farming. And I should mention that we milked Jersey cows, and to this day, we still love Jersey cows. Although, you know, all dairy farmers love their cows, but I have to say I have a real soft spot for Jerseys.
just describe to folks what Jersey cows are like, for people who might be listening in more urban areas who aren't familiar with cows.
Sure. Jersey cows are cows that probably look the most like deer of any of the standard dairy cows, in that they're kind of a marshmallow brown color with doe eyes and a black nose, and they're extremely beautiful dairy cows. They're also smaller than other. The most common breed are Holsteins, and they are larger cows than Jerseys are. Their Jersey cows might be 800 to 900 pounds for a mature cow, and Holsteins would be probably 1,100 pounds, or maybe even as much as 1,200 pounds. So they're smaller animals. We were interested in them because they were known to be very good grazers, and it just so happened that the individual who rented us the cows and then sold us the herd eventually happened to have a Jersey herd. And so it that's how we got into Jerseys.
Cool. I have some good memories on that Newton farm there. I mean, at least one memory that maybe it was a little traumatic where, I don't know, something like you had to unclog a cow or something like that. I remember, like, half of your arm being up the backside of a cow. I don't know if I remember that quite correctly, but I was like, oh my goodness.
Well, that would have been probably during artificial insemination. So that's a whole nother blog in itself.
Yeah.
So yes, we did artificial insemination.
Why would my parents allow me to be there when you were doing that? But okay, that's
That's a standard practice on many dairy farms.
I'm sure it is.
You know, and that's one of the points about dairy farming that a lot of people don't realize is that cows have a 9-month lactation period, and so the cow will have a calf, and then that cow is milked for that lactation period, and then typically is dried off. In other words, not milked for a period of time. And one of the keys to successful dairy farming is making sure that a cow can breed back on a regular basis once a year, and because that's what leads to the next lactation cycle. So that's part of it, Joe, is to make sure that those cows breed back on a regular basis. We ultimately then developed a seasonal dairy herd, and our goal was to have our cows calve in the springtime when the grass was coming on. And so by enabling them to calve in the spring when the grass is coming on means they would then have to be bred back in the summer, so that approximately 300, whatever the number of days are, 9 months later, they would then have a calf and start their next year's lactation. So that was our main goal, was to go to a seasonal dairy, especially because we were trying to be a grass or pasture-based operation. We did shift to a seasonal operation where we didn't milk cows in the wintertime, simply because for us, that was the most expensive time of the year to be feeding animals, because there's almost no grass growth in the wintertime, especially in the Midwest or even northern Pennsylvania. So that's ultimately what we led to, as a seasonal dairy operation. It's also possible to get a break from milking twice a day, to have a seasonal operation.
That would also make sense. Right. So I'm curious. It's a little fuzzy in my memory when exactly it was that you stopped doing the dairy farm full time and then moved to working to the state of Iowa. How did you make that transition?
Well, there were several things. One was I had actually gotten a job off the farm while I was still dairy farming. And so, like many beginning farmers, I was working off the farm while also operating the dairy farm. And then that was the time that we had two young boys, which also takes a certain amount of family time as well. So we had sold the dairy cows, and I'm trying to remember the year now, whether it was 1998, I believe. And then I eventually got a full-time job with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources in the year 2000. And at that time, because we still lived on our farm in Newton and had transitioned to raising beef cattle and chickens on pasture and getting out of the dairy operation, I started commuting from Newton, Iowa to Des Moines, which is a 35-mile commute plus gravel roads to get there. So that was the transition, was transitioning away from the day-to-day of the dairying. And it was several fold. One was that we really needed to have a bigger farm for it to be as economical as it could have been. And we were not able to expand our operation on that small farm at that time. And the other thing is that dairy farming, it takes an enormous amount of time. And this was a time when we had young sons. And so it's a trade-off between trying to make sure you can have enough time for your family and as well as other activities. So that was another factor, and not dairying anymore was simply the amount of time devoted to that. So by selling our dairy herd, I was able to be more of a dad, being a father to my sons, and was involved in many of their activities, including Boy Scouts, and I coached soccer and baseball and nearly every sport that our sons were involved with, which, quite frankly, I couldn't have done if I were still dairy farming. So it was a trade-off that way.
Yeah.
By raising other types of, you know, having other things that they could do, they may have learned to not enjoy the farm as much if we had that day-to-day slog of dairy farming. So it's kind of impossible to say at this point in time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Tell us about Iowa.
Well, I have traveled all across the state of Iowa, and I've traveled between Iowa and Pennsylvania many, many times, as you probably know. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about the differences between the two states and the similarities between the two states. I think a lot of people in the East who have never been to Iowa assume that it's flat and that it's all cornfields, and that's not true. It's a state of rolling hills, mostly.
Okay.
And there is an area of the state in the north central part of the state that is the flattest part of the state, so to speak. But most of the state is primarily rolling hills. And although there is a lot of corn raised in Iowa, and there are a lot of corn and soybean fields in the state, because that is the predominant landscape, is the agriculture in the state of Iowa. There are also a lot of very beautiful pastures and woodlands and haylands as well in the state of Iowa. So it has a fairly diverse landscape. The other thing I think people don't realize is that because farms have become so big, it's actually a relatively small percentage of the population of Iowa that farm for a living. It's probably at about 3% of the population farm for a living in the state of Iowa, which means by definition, 97% don't actually farm as an occupation. There are many who are involved with some sort of agricultural business that supports agriculture in the state of Iowa, but full-time farmers are actually, you know, at about 3% of the population. So it's much less than people know about.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The farming, farms in general, because the land is rolling hills, the farms have grown bigger over time. So it's very different than Pennsylvania agriculture, which there are some similarities, but Iowa doesn't have the mountains that Pennsylvania has. Most of the state and every county in the state still has a really high percentage of land that's in farms. The other thing people probably don't realize is that we do actually have some cities in Iowa as well. Not nearly as big as the major cities in Pennsylvania, of course. However, Des Moines is our capital city, and it has a population of, it's getting close to 250,000 in the city itself. And the metro area is about 500,000, and it continues to grow. And Joe, when I drove your parents into downtown Des Moines this summer, your mom said, "Wow, this feels like a big city." So, you know, it kind of looks and feels like an actual city. People who have never been to Iowa just do not think of cities in Des Moines, but they do exist. So that gives you a little bit of an idea about Iowa. There are similarities between the two states in that the northeastern part of the state, which is the part of the state that they call the driftless area because it was not covered by the most recent glaciers, so it wasn't flattened out as much, is actually an area of pretty deep of limestone bluffs and hills and trout streams, cold water streams. It's a really beautiful area of the state that I love a lot, and it reminds me of certain areas of Pennsylvania, except that the hills are not nearly as steep as the hills in Pennsylvania, nor does Iowa have the mountain ranges.
So let's circle back to your current job that you have now. Just describe what's your job title and what do you do for IDNR?
My job title is that I'm the non-point source coordinator for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And that's a title that doesn't mean much to many people because it doesn't describe what it is. So this is where I have to define what that is. It's really a position. It's a position that deals with water quality of lakes and streams in the state of Iowa. Non-point source pollution is a term that EPA created when it developed the non-point source program that's an offshoot of the Clean Water Act that provides funding for pollution that comes from runoff. In other words, point source is defined as pollution that comes out of a pipe. So wastewater treatment plants or industries that discharge pollution out of a pipe, that's considered point source pollution. Everything else that doesn't come from a pipe is lumped under the term non-point source. It reminds me of the difference between fiction and nonfiction. It doesn't define it by what it is. It defines it by what it's not. However, non-point source pollution refers mostly to runoff from farm fields or from urban areas or any sort of runoff from the land that then pollutes whatever water body is downstream in that watershed, lakes or streams or wetlands. So in my job as the non-point source coordinator, I do several things. One is that I administer a grant that is called the Section 319 grant that every state gets. Pennsylvania gets the 319 grant. We get that grant in the state of Iowa. We use that grant from the EPA to fund watershed projects around the state to help improve the water quality of lakes and streams within that watershed. Okay. And in addition, I manage Iowa's non-point source plan, which is to administer statewide projects that are funded through this EPA Section 319 grant. So in essence, that's what my job is. And it's the person in Pennsylvania who is the 319 coordinator does very similar type of work. The difference is that the sources of pollution might differ a little bit between what Iowa and Pennsylvania. Most of our work is dealing with runoff from farm fields.
Okay.
And we do also have some practices that are trying to address pollution coming from urban areas as well, but primarily it's coming from farm fields. We're working in watersheds around the state where we're trying to reduce the amount of pollution coming from agricultural fields.
Sure.
And so that might mean providing extra funding for building terraces or grade stabilization structures that stop soil erosion, or funding management practices like cover crops or no-till and on agricultural fields, again, to help reduce soil erosion and reduce runoff from fertilizers or other types of runoff coming from farm fields.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I mean, I imagine in Pennsylvania, you know, we still have a lot of issues with, you know, now where we live now, there's still a lot of issues with like mine runoff and that sort of thing. We still have, we are right on the edge of the western coal region in Pennsylvania. And I don't ever remember hearing about mines in Iowa. So I would think that's not something y'all have to worry about. So in thinking about
Iowa used to have quite a few coal mines in southern Iowa.
Wow.
They're no longer active, but there are still some old areas of old coal mining areas, and there is now a grant program to help restore some of those old coal mine areas, and that's another story in itself. Most of the mines in Iowa are gravel pits or rock mine. The rock is so different in Iowa compared to what you have in Pennsylvania, where you have coal and you've got granite that you can see all over the place. In Iowa, mostly what's under the soil is limestone. And so what's quarried is usually for limestone, crushed limestone for rock.
Okay.
In the state. Yep, very different.
Yeah, there's the place. So we live close to Elk County in Pennsylvania, which has been really interesting.
Yeah.
But there's a place in Elk County that's been, it was an old coal mine that's been restored, And now it's an elk viewing area, and you can watch the elk grazing on the fields. And it's actually really beautiful.
I've heard about elk counting.
Yeah, you guys will have to come visit sometime.
I'd like to.
When it gets warm.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
You know, speaking of that, another difference, I'd say, between just getting back to your question about what's Iowa like, is that it's most of the state has towns and farm fields, so it has much less wild land than Pennsylvania does. As you know, with the mountains in Pennsylvania or even Elk County, you have large areas of the state that are now in areas that are considered wild or managed as wild lands. Iowa has very little of that. Most of the state is in farming, and it's only very small areas that are set aside either as public land, as prairie, or there are a few state forests. But our largest contiguous piece of land that's either in a state forest or a prairie is about 5,000 acres. Compared to Pennsylvania, where you have much, much larger areas of land that are either in state forest or national forest land. So, that's a big difference, is that we have much less wild land.
That does make a lot of sense. Yeah, we're just a little bit north of us, you know, a big area that Interstate 80 passes through is the Pennsylvania Wilds.
Yes.
I guess there isn't an Iowa Wilds?
Not nearly to the same extent.
Yeah.
There isn't the largest state forest in the state of Iowa is Yellow River State Forest up in northeast Iowa, and it's a beautiful, really rugged, wooded piece of land. So, yeah, it's about as wild as Iowa gets. But again, compared to Pennsylvania, there's no comparison. It's not nearly as.
I think we could compare all day. We could even throw in some other states. Now let's compare it to like Washington State, and now let's compare it to Arizona. But we could stop there with the comparisons, or we should compare to Tennessee, where I'm originally from.
Tennessee has a little bit of everything, which makes it very interesting too.
Yeah, it's very interesting too. But let's go with this question, because we're talking to someone from Iowa. It would be so interesting to know what it's like to live in Iowa during the months leading up to the presidential caucuses. Can you describe that for us?
Sure. Yep, I can describe that. And I would probably start out by saying that I think Iowans have mixed feelings about that entire process. On the one hand, because a lot of people don't really know that much about Iowa, all of a sudden, before the Iowa caucuses, there are so many people from around the world or from around the country who descend upon the state, including presidential candidates, that I think on the one hand, some Iowans, especially if they're interested in politics, are very intrigued by that and interested to hear what political candidates have to say, especially kind of at the beginning of the political process. And the benefits of that process is that Iowans get a chance to see political candidates in a relatively small setting. And I'm saying that before COVID-19, COVID-19 has changed everything. But before that, it would mean that presidential candidates would go to coffee shops around the state in small towns or community centers. So, people got a chance to look them in the eye, ask them serious questions, and they had a chance to respond and really listen to the questions from people. So in some ways, it really gave a really close contact between Iowans and presidential candidates. However, the closer it gets to the election time period and the time of the Iowa caucus, that's when people really start to get tired of it, because there are so many television commercials that are on, and there are most of the television commercials, or many of them, are negative ads that people get so tired of, and you've seen them as well, that after a while we can't wait for it to get over with. So it's kind of a mixed bag. On the one hand, there's a lot of interest, and then on the other hand, we can't wait until it's over with. So, and this year was totally different.
Hi, Aunt Sarah. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing good.
Good.
I'm interrupting.
What do you think of the Iowa caucus process?
Oh, Peter's shouting from the other room. He's saying outdated.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it's something that a diverse population can equally participate in. Who can be free on a weekday evening?
Mm. Okay.
Elderly people can't get out. People of color, or people of lower socioeconomic backgrounds, or people that are working second shift can't get off work. You know, there's all kinds of barriers to participation. So I think it's fun to participate in, but I don't think everybody has equal access to participating. But I'll let you guys continue. I just wanted to say hello.
Yeah, it's nice to
see you later.
Yep, see ya.
Yeah.
Getting back to the Iowa caucus, I've participated in Iowa caucuses in several different places. And 20 years ago, I went to one that was in our rural neighborhood. And so it was in the living room of somebody's farmhouse.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, it was a really small group, and we had a chance to sit in the living room and discuss candidates. So that was really interesting. However, like Sarah talked about, no, it was not easy to get to. It was far away on a gravel road, but I was able to participate and had an interesting discussion. That was the smallest one I'd ever been to. Whereas back this past February, now that we live in Des Moines, I went to the caucus that was at Hoover High School, which is one of the high schools here in Des Moines. You know, I don't know how many people were there, but it was held in the high school gymnasium. So there were thousands of people there. Quite a difference from 20 years ago when I was in my neighbor's farm living room.
Yeah.
But that's the difference between it. And Sarah's right that it's something to vote in, it having to go somewhere to participate in it is a very different thing than if you're voting, you know, either going to a voting booth or sending in something by mail. And again, you know, that happened before COVID-19. Now that we're after COVID-19, the world looks entirely different. So who knows what's going to happen with the Iowa caucuses from here on out.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
I guess there was one more question that I did not include in the list that I sent you, but it just occurred to me, thinking about how you lived outside and then in Newton for, you know, 20-odd years. I think I remember that wasn't the Maytag Corporation based out of Newton, or had big offices there or something?
Yep, Maytag was headquartered in Newton, Iowa, and had several factories in Newton, Iowa. And unfortunately, that it got bought out by Whirlpool, and everything in Maytag closed down. So Newton, Iowa, lost 4,300 jobs.
Oh wow!
You know, a town of 15,000 over a period of the 10 years as it was downsizing, and then it sold to Whirlpool in 2007. That's when it officially closed. So, that was a big hit for the town of Newton. You know, I know that there are other communities in the country that have suffered something similar to that. But yeah, that was a major blow to the town of Newton.
So what was it like to live through that period in Newton?
Well, the time period when Newton was losing Maytag, it didn't happen all at once, but there were, over a period of years, there was downsizing going on where certain functions of Maytag was being closed, and then ultimately the whole thing was folded. But it meant that gradually over a period of time, there were people, friends of ours, members of our church, who left the community and moved to different parts of the country. And so that was the sad part, is that we saw a number of friends of ours who left the Newton community and were no longer in church, were no longer in school. And Maytag was not only a factory, it was also as the headquarters town, and it included executives from Maytag, engineers who had been longtime Maytag people. So the town of Newton lost a lot of people with a lot of talent, you know, community leaders when Maytag left. So the people who stayed then were those people who either were able to find another way to make a living, and or were very determined to stay in Newton and to stay in Iowa, and that, you know, to their credit, but it was a huge economic hit for that town of Newton.
Yeah.
And I think in our church, which that was First Presbyterian Church in Newton, just because I know you're a pastor and you have Sunday school, we lost 60 kids from Sunday school over about a 5-year period.
Wow.
In our church. And that wasn't just our, you know, that was just one church in Newton, but every church in Newton had that happen. So, you know, that's the downside, is that losing so many people in one community is always a difficult thing. They have developed new businesses in Newton since then, you know, that has helped restore some of the jobs, but the average pay is about half what the Maytag salaries were. So, you know, the amount of wealth is not there compared to what it used to be 20 years ago. Nevertheless, we enjoyed living in Newton, and our sons enjoyed Newton and going to school there. There was that feeling, though, that, you know, the, just the closing of Maytag was something that was a major factor in the community.
Right. And that's something that, you know, sadly a lot of different small towns and rural communities have gone through over the past 30 and 40 years now. There are so many four-letter towns throughout Pennsylvania and Tennessee, I would say, that have been through similar things. With a whole lot of people who remember the glory days, wish that they would come back, and well, I just don't think that they're going to.
Not in the same way.
Certainly not in the same way.
Yeah. So it means needing to come up with other ways to make a living and maintain a community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I guess brings up one more thing, something that Casey usually likes to end an interview with. But what exactly is bringing you hope these days? You know, we're in the middle of this global pandemic and a very divisive election, which, you know, of course, U.S. and Iowa had an oversized role in, of course. But what's bringing you hope these days, and what kind of hope could you share with other people?
Yeah, great question. It's difficult to answer that when we're still in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And however, just looking at that one example of the virus and the pandemic, I have hope that now that I'm seeing vaccines that are coming out, that hopefully all of us at some point will have access to getting a vaccine that will enable us to get past the pandemic. And, you know, whenever that happens to most of the country and most of the world, we hope that that will enable us to return to life as we knew it, when we were able to meet with each other face to face in normal settings, whether it's at home or at school or at work, so we can be social creatures again, like we haven't been able to do since about March of last year. And I believe that will happen. I just don't know exactly when it's going to happen. Yeah. I know it's starting to happen. So it gives me hope that it will happen, that we can return to the way we used to be as social creatures. Another type of hope is that we're probably having this conversation on Zoom because of the virus, that the virus has caused other types of communication to flourish that didn't happen before that. And so, you know, you're able to talk with me from Northern Pennsylvania, whereas we probably never would have thought of that if it weren't for this. And it does show that in times of hardship, we can come up with creative ways to deal with that hardship. And this is a creative way, this particular way of communicating. So I have hope that whatever hardships we have down the road, we can find creative ways to deal with it.
And I love ending on that. So thank you for everything. And we'll continue to find creative ways to talk and chat. And it's so good that we can do this on Zoom and we can see your face because we're actually here together and see your family walk in and connect with them again. But this is awesome.
Yeah.
So I love that last statement, find creative ways to continue leading into the hope. So
yeah,
that's perfect.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been so interesting, and I'm glad to learn more about you and your work and the very important work that you've done throughout the years with dairy cows and then with the water and just the work in Iowa. It's very important. So thank you for sharing all of that knowledge with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be a part of this. So, and it's your creative way of reaching out to the rest of the world. So in a way, it's an extension of your ministry. So thank you for that.
You are very, very welcome.